So what I actually like to do is to, this is a project that's still evolving, and I presented it to a few different groups over the course of the summer. I presented it to some people working in the values and science literature. I presented it to people in philosophy and biology, and now I'm presenting it to this crowd just to get some feedback on it. And the reason why I wanted to present it to different groups is what I'm doing is something that's a little bit unusual, both for me and for the literature, which is I want to take two literatures and put them together to see if anything useful happens. So there's this long-standing debate over whether and how it's appropriate to use race in medicine, either for research purposes or for clinical practice. And then there's this literature called the Values in Science literature, led by people like Heather Douglas, on what are the appropriate roles of values when we're doing scientific practice. The things like inductive risk is sort of one of the biggest concepts they've been using most recently. And so I'd like to present how I've been trying to make some sense out of it. It's a little bit different than what I presented in the abstract because this is still evolving. So all of that said, let's see what happens when we put these two things together. Well, the way I see this debate starting, and I'll have to spend a little bit of time sort of setting this up, is I see the race in medicine debate as being, in some sense, started with the gauntlet that was thrown down by what's called the race eliminativists. So these are the people who said, look at what race has done inside medicine, the history of abuses that just goes on and on and on. We have every reason to get rid of this awful, awful concept. It has done so much harm. I don't think I need to go into too many details in this crowd. Race has done bad things. So we're good. And so as a result, you have suggestions saying that, well, what race needs is to pay attention to genetic factors and to social factors. The last thing we need is something that's going to conflate the two. You also have suggestions that maybe we could try to replace it with something else that's not as slippery or ambiguous or problematic, like ethno-ancestral, bio-ethnic, ethno-bio-historical, et cetera, et cetera. You haven't heard of these before because they haven't really caught on. And it's also... And also, because race is so unique, it's not really clear that you even could capture what was being captured by race in the first place. So is it really replaceable in the first place? Not exactly. And so as a result, you have people trying to conserve it. So these are what's called the race conservationists, who say that actually, no, we do want to keep some sort of role or roles for race in medicine, despite the long, long list of historical abuses and contemporary ones. One approach is the one taken by actually my co-author, a public health physician and epidemiologist, who essentially says that given that we know that there are health disparities between people who are identified by one race or another in contemporary populations, we know that this is the case. There are higher rates of cancer in this group than in this one, higher rates of social deprivation, things like that. We know those problems exist, and so given that we need to solve problems that are bad, we have an ethical obligation to address them, and so addressing addressing essentially the social consequences and medical consequences of racism requires that we talk about race. And so, at the very least, we need to use race in that sense. And so, this flips around the challenge that's thrown down by the eliminativists in saying, actually, given that we have this problem to solve, you eliminativists, you have the challenge of trying to prove to us why we shouldn't use race. And so trying to flip around that script. There's another approach, which is actually the one taken by Jay Cohn, who became famous for being essentially the leading force behind the development of the drug Bidil, which became known inside the United States and also abroad for being the first drug approved for the treatment of a medical condition in exclusively one race. So this is for the treatment of heart failure in African-American populations. That caused quite an uproar, which actually still remains now. And so what Cohn actually says is, despite sort of being this sort of pioneer in race-based medicine, says that, well, observed racial differences in disease frequency, maybe genetically, rather than racially or geographically determined, is not really about race necessarily. But in the absence of more refined technology, the racial designation, crude as it is, serves as a useful and available surrogate. So we don't have the perfect technology. What we have is these trends across racial groups. And there's a lot to unpack there, but in one area, I think he actually is correct, which is that I see medicine as the land of proxy variables. We do not have direct access to the things that interest us about individuals or populations all of the time. So we measure serum cholesterol rather than atherosclerosis directly. And this goes on and on and on, a million examples. My favorite one's BMI. So body mass index. So body mass index is reasonably predictive of a wide range of health conditions, metabolic conditions, and cardiovascular conditions. Obesity is defined as having a BMI of greater than or equal to 30. Is that me calling somebody?
No, it's somebody calling you.
You're about to have, I didn't mean to interrupt. He's John Fuller with Maple Bigots, so he wants to listen to your talk.
Oh, hello. So body mass index greater than or equal to 30. This is the definition of obesity in a widely used one by the World Health Organization. By the way, if you're interested in the whole proxy variable thing, I have a paper on it, so I can send it to you. The interesting thing about BMI, it's a ratio of kilograms in weight to meters in height. There's no reason why the cutoff point for being obese would be a round number, except because it's a round number. Because it's not 29.9, it's not 30.05, it's 30.0. So I love how openly obvious it is that this is arbitrary. So that's why it's my favorite proxy variable. Because it's basically yelling at you, I'm a heuristic. But that doesn't mean there's something wrong with it necessarily, or that we should eliminate it. And so we know there are absurd cases, like this obese gentleman here. He has a BMI of 31. That's Dwayne Johnson. And so, yes, it is ridiculous. We can point out these sorts of things. BMI is problematic. Ask him. That's what he's yelling about, I'm sure. And interestingly, despite what Cohn says, there actually are better technologies. So better technology doesn't necessarily replace something like BMI, which we know is broken. And so we can use skinfold calipers to measure adiposity that way, as opposed to some sort of crude measurement of weight and height. We can do hydrostatic weighing. We can weigh people underwater to get a much more precise measure of their body fat composition. But we don't do those things in most cases, because they're kind of a pain in the ass to do. And so we do the simpler version instead. And we also have the ability to do very interesting things like track BMI distribution and trends for over 100 years within a single population to see what happens there, which is information that would not be comparable if we tried to use hydrostatic weighing now as opposed to BMI then. So just because it's imprecise and crude doesn't mean it's bad or should be abandoned. Okay, so one of the reasons why I wanted to take a look at this literature on race and medicine from the angle of the values in science literature is partially because there's this value neutrality rhetoric that's employed by people who use race very badly inside medicine, and we all know certain cases. Here are a couple of them. So here is Richard Lynn, a very infamous race and IQ researcher. Somebody asked him a few years ago what he wanted to see in his obituary. I don't want to make a comment there, but I'm on tape. He says, I want to see that some loved him, some hated him, but everyone accepted that he kept the faith and told the truth as he saw it. And to him, the truth is that there is dysgenic trends inside populations and inferior races breeding and yada, 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 horrible, horrible things. But he's just telling the truth as he sees it, so that's okay. Or we have Nevin Cesarditch, the philosopher of biology, who has what I sometimes call old-fashioned views on race. And he was criticized recently by Adam Hodgman, another philosopher of biology, and says, well, Hodgman even goes so far as to accuse me of writing a paper in the attempt to legitimize claims of racial superiority. What to say? In discussions about race and biology, morphological and genetic differences between human groups can still be debated with impunity. But raising the same issue about psychological differences among groups apparently crosses the line. And so he's not an idiot, and so he's aware that there are very particular issues that have arisen in the past about talking about racial differences and intellectual ability, and why we should be extra cautious about these sorts of things. But he doesn't have to worry about that, because he's just making value-neutral statements of fact. And so that's fine. But obviously it's not fine, so how is it not fine? So where this actually led me was a different place than what I expected. I thought I was going to get a lot of value out of this whole epistemic risk thing, and there's some of that in here, but what I actually found most useful in this values in science literature was actually some work by Elizabeth Anderson, who's part of the literature, but is sort of treated as a bit sort of tangential or a little bit sort of on the margins of the literature. And so she makes this interesting case in a paper back in 1995 saying that the decision to study some X, let's say race, you can't justify that decision simply on the basis that that theoretical classification satisfies the standard of epistemic significance. So basically, being epistemically significant isn't a good enough reason to study something, which seems a bit odd on the face of it. But she uses an example that I think is very helpful in trying to prove why this alone is not sufficient. So she uses the example of unemployment. And so in the United States, and in actually many other countries, the standard definition of unemployment is not the same thing as what people think of when they think of unemployment. When we hear unemployment, we think somebody who doesn't have a job. You only count as unemployed, with a capital U, I suppose, if you are actively seeking a job. If you look out at your job prospects, you see that there's not even the slightest chance you're going to get one. You go back home and you say, I quit. You are no longer unemployed. You have to be actively seeking employment. And so there are people who worry about what's called hidden unemployment. There is attention to this. And so people who criticize this concept of unemployment for being essentially not accurately measuring what we care about, they could say to the people who use this concept, you should use something else. This is a terrible definition of unemployment. But the people who like this definition can say, oh, but our definition is actually epistemically significant. It's even causally significant because it's the definition we use when we set our interest rates. And so it's significant because it's significant. See, get it? And that seems rather hollow. It's a cheap way of buying epistemic significance. But it's actually not entirely different from why race is significant. So why are there, for example, in the United States, huge disparities in life expectancy between black populations and white populations? Because of racism. So why should we measure race? Racism. The significance can be bought, in some sense, rather cheaply. And so we should be very careful about essentially having circular reasoning for this sort of thing. Now, before I go on, I want to flag something. This actually, I think, is another area where the literature is being helpful. And so it's not just a matter of how we use values, or not if and when we use values to inform our scientific practice, or how we think about the relationship between the values and evidence. That's a dichotomy that's problematic. I know, we can get into that. It's not just that. It's also a matter of the way in which we think about it in a more nuanced sense. And so there's concern, even among those who study this literature, that those who talk about values and evidence, that they sometimes give special priority to evidence over values. This is what Matt Brown and Dan Hicks have alternatively called the lexical priority of evidence or truth. And so there's a certain tacit assumption that when we talk about values and evidence, we should have like a long conversation about evidence, and then if there's like a leftover problem afterwards, that's when we can start talking about values. And so it's always the priority is given to the evidence. And that's problematic because if we really take it seriously, we should actually not just sort of push it into a secondary status. And that's what you actually see inside the literature on race in medicine. So for example, you have Rotimi giving a very nice critique of the use of race in medicine and says that while the label used to designate the African American population in studies like the clinical trial for Bidil, that's drug for heart failure in African Americans, is too imprecise to be relevant for individual therapy. Some members of this population supergroup with heart failure will benefit from the drug and others will not. Which is actually almost trivially true, that the word African-American obviously is quite broad and not very precise, but that imprecision in and of itself is taken as reason to eliminate it from consideration. We don't need to have a conversation about how many lives would be saved, or about quality-adjusted life years, or about cost savings, or whatever else, or whether patient demand for it would be significant in this way or another. None of that needs to even happen because the evidence already eliminates it from consideration. And so in reply to that kind of move, you have people like Kofi Makolo, philosopher of biology and medicine, saying, well, actually, you need to be very careful because, yes, race, as a crude indicator, is unlikely to help further our theoretical understanding of the subtle ways in which proper population substructure-sensitive research contributes to advancing the unified goal of personalized equal care in modern scientific medicine. I'll come back to that point. This epistemic issue, however, does not provide a sufficient reason to eliminate the concept of race from biomedicine. For race eliminativism to be justified, one also needs to show, on ethical grounds, that biomedical race research and race-based therapeutics are morally objectionable from the patient perspective. So essentially, it's not enough to say that race is imprecise. We also need to say that actually it's going to be harmful to patients. This, paired with Anderson's point, leads us to a very interesting position. Anderson says epistemic significance is not enough to accept the use of race in medicine. This point says epistemic weaknesses aren't good enough to eliminate it from consideration. And so that leaves us in a very awkward position. It's interesting, though, that even in the case of Maklow, who's trying to say that actually we need to be much more attentive to the way we think about these values and evidence considerations, even he makes an interesting move, where he actually ends up kicking lexical priority out the front door, but actually lets it in the window. And this is something I think the values in science literature can help bring to this conversation, is to be very, very, very cautious about how we think about these sorts of things. Because there's a certain tacit assumption going on underneath here about the way that evidence works inside medicine. So Maklow makes this point that it's all about advancing the unified goal of personalized equal care in modern scientific medicine. Rotimi actually says almost exactly the same thing. We're all working towards the ultimate goal of genotype-based medicine. This is what Kahn calls the politics of the meantime in pharmacogenomics, that someday in the near-ish future, we'll have all treatments tailored individually to all patients, and everyone gets exactly the care that they and only they need. And it's only in the meantime, in our current dark ages, that we have to worry about things like populations or trends or inferences from one's social groups. And so we're all sort of working towards that bright future. And so the shared assumption is that if you get more precise evidence, it will solve your ethical and epistemic problems, that we don't have to worry about these things in the future. And that's wonderful. But as my colleague Len Fleck has pointed out, actually the process of fine-tuning personalized care has unlimited costs but diminishing returns. And so after my doctor takes my BMI, he can also use skinfold caliper measurements to further ascertain my body adiposity. He can also do hydrostatic weighing. He can call on other experts who are better trained in these things. And it goes on and on and on. You can always, always, always run more tests. And so the problem is that more personalized care actually creates less equal care when you have limited resources. And so this idea that we can sort of work in a sort of obvious way towards, oh, it's all about personalized equal care. Like, actually, personalized equal care is probably not a thing ever. And so we should be very, very careful about how we make these assumptions about the way the evidence is actually going to operate. Okay, so this is still a work in process, but what I want to say is that is something that's not really entirely different in kind from what's been said by other people, which is if we're going to take a look at evidence and values and consider both of these features together, when we make our deliberations over something like the role of race in medicine, then we shouldn't give values basically second-class status. A few other people have made recent comments to me, so like maybe they aren't as dichotomous as they seem. Totally agree. Definitely granted. And maybe we should even interrogate how exactly some of these things got the designation. Oh, that's just a value, and that's just an evidentiary issue. That's something that actually, and historically, that could be very, very important here, so granted. And this is in line with what I've said and what Nancy Tuana has said, and among other people, that basically if we're going to evaluate values and evidence considerations, that we should evaluate them jointly. And so what we're left with in this case is that in this literature on race and medicine that has endless debates over race's precision, its underlying biology, how good or bad the genomic data is, et cetera, et cetera. Well, none of that is actually going to give us a sufficient reason to use race in medicine. It's also not going to give us a sufficient reason to reject race from medicine. And so given that those sorts of deliberations are not going to get us anywhere, where does that leave us? It leaves us very much in need of having some very serious conversations about what values we have here. And so what are we trying to achieve, and what are our objectives, and what are we valuing over other things? And so that's where this needs to go next. Thank you. Question. 9 seconds early.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, I laughed. That was a sympathetic giggle. everybody will hate you, or I think from one literature might hate you.
I thought I already did that by choosing my topic.
So this is a somebody sympathetic to your project. I think it's great.
Mm-hmm.
But I do wonder how likely it is that we're going to make progress in this way. So at least one, I think, the kind of issues that feature that make the even the existing debates, right, where some of the conservationists do effectively say there are perhaps value-laden reasons as well for keeping these things, is that the values simply aren't going to be aligned, because we know that something might well, on the one hand, we need this to study, say, particular kind of social processes, and we might well have a value-laden reason for doing it because it's really important to document racism,
mm-hmm.
but we just know that that's going to entrench into some people the view that this is some kind of biological essential, which we can all hopefully agree is a bad thing.
Yeah, the
so,
false sense of genetic essentialism is the way it sometimes, yeah.
And so it's quite likely that if we lift the debate to values, we're going to be in at least equal amounts of disagreements, because they're just going to be pointing in such different directions for the very same issues.
Yeah, so I've sort of, for pretty much all questions in these sorts of cases, I have sort of like the optimistic answer and the pessimistic answer. The optimistic answer is actually, I think if people were, I've had a lot of people complain to me, it's like, I hate filling out race information on forms. It makes me super uncomfortable, especially at my doctor. I don't know what they're going to do with that information. That freaks me out. If it was explained to people more clearly that the purpose is, like, actually what we're trying to do is to track and eliminate patterns of racism. We know that there are problems, like, for example, that in a study in California, it was one of my favorites, doctors don't give very good painkillers to non-white patients. They give opiate painkillers to white patients, and they give the sort of lesser painkillers to non-white patients, which is disturbing as hell. But we wouldn't know that was the case if we didn't collect information about every single patient who's admitted. If that was and then I tell people that, it's like, oh, that makes sense. But we'll tell them that, and tell them it's about the value of trying to actually track and respond to racism, as opposed to, oh, we're going to give you the black drugs or the white drugs. Like, there's a difference there. And so having those clear conversations about values, that actually could help. Pessimistically, yes, it still kind of freaks people out, and they'll hate it.
Thanks. So part of what you said might be should we research racial IQ differences? He has a funny argument which goes along the lines of, well, it's not going to do any good, and it's going to do some harm.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever happens, you know, the kind of cost benefit goes against it.
Yeah, that was the direction I was originally, that's what I thought the paper was going to be about.
Okay.
And then it ended up sort of being one slide.
Okay.
It's like, oh yeah, well then, yeah that would be bad, wouldn't it?
I
need to keep it. Maybe you can give me another slide out of this. I'm trying to.
So what I was wondering was, you know, whenever I read that argument picture, I guess part of me wants to say, evidence for saying it's going to only lead to harm, can't lead to benefit. It looks like
history.
The claims themselves are going to depend. It's sort of like once you've got values in place,
mm-hmm.
you don't want to do harm, you do want to do benefit. Once you concede as well, that's relevant to research, and what you shouldn't research. None of that in the science tells you what to do. You still need to do more empirical research.
Right? Yeah.
If you guys said, when we do more empirical research, we still need the values to come in. But where do you get value double counting? So to speak, the values are determining what comes into research, what you're researching. Values determine perhaps what research you do. The values determine how you do research.
So maybe we should give give some lexical priority to evidence over values. Is that what you're saying? There's actually some more stuff that Anderson's written on exactly this topic on research questions. She uses the example of anti-Semitic histories. And so there can be problems if you formulate a research question like, in what ways did the Jews cause these kinds of horrible things? Like, whoa, 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 even your research question seems to be deeply problematic. And so she has some more nuanced literature. I can send you some of the work on this if it'd be helpful to you. That the process of forming a research question actually is a step in which we need to take into consideration what our values and objectives are. And so, there are better and worse ways of doing that. So it's the research question design period is not a free for all, because you can do it. You can do it in a way that will lead you more in better or worse ways towards accurate and responsible research.
Heschel, thanks for your talk.
Hey.
just wanted your thoughts about how this could potentially extend to the social categorization of gender.
Basically, could we like replace race with gender in a lot of these cases and run the same thing again, something like that?
I just want some of your thoughts, just so I'm just curious. Do you see there being an extension? Do you see there being something more intersectional, or these two terms of maybe coexisting in some aspects and not in others? Just some thoughts on that.
That's another topic that interests me. I hadn't tried sort of doing the find and replace version to see whether all this carries through again. When it comes to the way that race and let me know if I'm running out of time. When it comes to the way this operates, a lot of the work I've been doing recently is on administrative data collection in medicine, and so I find deeply problematic I think it's great that the Target finally got rid of its girls' toys section versus boys' toys section. Wonderful step in progress. When people are applying for jobs or going to the hospital, should we be tracking whether or not female patients are being over or under prescribed certain drugs? Yeah, we still need to do that. And so when it comes to the administrative tracking, then we need that data in order to track sexism. So at the very least, there's that part of it, I think, does work. I'm pretty confident that it would work there. As far as other aspects of this, I might be missing some other aspects. I don't want to overcommit to the answer. But yeah, a lot of the same issues.
So I wonder if you would draw out your conclusion for the case of Baidu.
Mm-hmm. Everybody always wants me to talk about Baidu all the time.
Yes. To make it concrete.
Yes.
If it's the case that we can do the most good by prescribing this drug on the basis of this,
yeah,
then we should continue.
Yes.
That's something like the argument.
Yeah. That's what Cohen essentially says, yeah.
But, you know, there are reasons to think, from what we know at the seminary, that it's not going to really do very much.
Yeah, and so I think there are good ways and bad ways of critiquing Baidu. I think Rotimi's way of saying, well, it's an imprecise label, and so let's just stop there. Mm-hmm. I think that's not entirely helpful, or at least the way I read that one section. Rotimi says a lot of things, and it's sort of hard to sort through. But there another better way is to say, look, let's look at whether or not this is actually going to help patients, and take into consideration whether this imprecise tool is actually going to cause predictable good effects inside the population. If the answer is no, because it was sort of a hack job when it came to coming up with the clinical data to support it, well then, based on that, we can kick it out of consideration because it doesn't do anything, or it doesn't do very much good, or for all of its negative effects.
Yeah,
like that. Yeah.
Pretty
much always. Yeah.
You're not going to get a success. You're not going to help patients a whole lot unless you got.
Yeah, and that's actually what my other paper is exactly on, is on the linking of ethical and epistemic features and how we can actually sort of use those inside a unified system. So, yeah, which I didn't actually use for this paper, but separate issue.
Well, at that point, I think we better
thank you.